Major Plowman, reel 14. You were saying that something happened to one of your honeys in the area around Perugia.
Yes. They said they were speeding along over this hilly but pasty country grassland towards the ridge, and which one or two steep. Suddenly they came under heavy shell fire. And of course they turned around another hour to get to withdraw and to attract. That was, they wouldn't have done that normally, you see, but it was of course they were agitated, the driver was agitated and we recovered it the next day. I took the yes, my we had a mechanist sergeant, you know, we had a mechanist sergeant in the squadron. I took him out in the squad car, and he did it. Now, that's quite an example of courage. Most of us, especially the troop leaders, were quite young, in their early 20s. Certainly at the beginning of our operational activity, we weren't all that scared. As time went on, we got more and more cautious and more easily scared.
Was that because of experience?
Yes. But we were young. Now, some of the older people who were in administrative tasks, they were very worried about the possibility of being a casualty. And this was such a person. And we were given some attention by the enemy, as a mortifier, I think. But nothing landed very near. And he carried out this job, shaking like a leaf. But he stuck at it and did it. God was going. I got my tank back and had the full complement of my troop. And I thought, well, that's true courage when you really are scared to death. It's affecting you physically and yet you persist. So there we are, just in passing.
Did you mentioned this process happening to you, that you became less bold and more cautious, yeah, as time went on, because you became more frightened,
yeah,
as time went on. Did that also happen to your soldiers, as far as you could tell?
I think so, yes, I think so. Of course, the nearer the war came to it, the end of the war loomed, more people were conscious that they didn't want to spoil everything and become a casualty at the very last moment, you know. And I think some of the senior officers were affected a bit like that. They got more and more cautious. But, you know, there was this general feeling it's not really worth it, but the war's going to end anyway. I'm not sure, I don't think it affected me too greatly, but I did find I was a bit, yes, I was more cautious in my operations in the last campaign than I was a year earlier. But I didn't actually, I don't think that was physical fear, it was just a bit of fear of an unknown. Where would they pop up from next?
Do you know if you had any psychiatric casualties in the squadron or the regiment as a result of these factors, the approaching end of the war and the prolonged experience uncertainty and danger.
I can't call anything mine, but of course I am in the Leary Valley. I think I've mentioned it earlier that I had one member of my crew who was virtually a nervous wreck, but that was only after being in action 5 days. It's that some individuals had this apprehension which took them over, you see. I had to ask for him to be replaced. But, but I don't remember any other person like that. We know a lot of the men had been through North Africa and lost comrades and so on. And they were very apprehensive. And of course there were one or two who were the butts. One or two who had administrative jobs like in the quartermasters, on the quartermaster side, who weren't coming near the front if they could possibly help it. And they were subject to some, well, jocular cracks and so on. But they tended all to, people like that tended to be in late 30s, married men.
More to lose, perhaps.
Yeah.
Were any of your tank crewmen married? Did you notice if that made any difference to their approach to these things?
I didn't know they were. My sergeant was married. He'd be something like 36, 37, 38. And he was pretty happy, and he was jolly good, you know, he supported me and everything in the field and off the field. It was more testing for the older ones. A lot of the senior officers are all married, you see. Especially if they weren't regulars. The regulars, often the regulars, regulars were either very good or very bad.
What number of regulars did you have in the regiment?
Well, I think in the officers. A commanding officer from landing in North Africa to, from the summer of 42 to May 44 was an 11th hussar. He was completely without fill. But then we had a regular quartermaster and one or two other staff for the NCO as well, but mostly the rest were territorials or civilian soldiers. We had a troop leader, one of our older troop leaders. He had been in the he'd been an officer, a regular officer, and had left the army and joined up again in 1939. And one of the squadron leaders who left after the North African campaign, he was the same. He'd been in the Grenadier Guards. But by and large, we were all civilian soldiers. But, you know, the previous commanding officer of the Derbyshire Yeomanry was a regular, of course, He was commandant of Sandhurst during my time, and of course I had a great admiration for him.
And you said that the regulars were either very good or very bad. If they were very bad, what ways were they very bad?
Well, they beat and drink a bit too much and know all the tricks, but they don't get much done on that sort of thing. You come across me, don't they? In the training regiment, in the depots, I met people I didn't admire that greatly. But that's a bit of an extreme statement, I suppose. The ones that were good, I put it this way, I'd rather serve in war under a good regular than a good civilian officer. They were dedicated and distinctive soldiers. we got the Pedro, and as I say, we trained there for several weeks, and then.
What was the content of the training? Were you training for the usual reconnaissance and screening work, or
yes,
did you have nothing different then?
No. We were at Pedro about a month. And then, to the best of my memory, the attack began. The army attacked on the 10th of April. And the 600th Division were poised to break through, which they did through the Argenta Gap.
And by this stage, the war was getting very far advanced in Western Europe, wasn't it? The Rhine crossings were taking place and things like that were going on. Were you in touch with that sort of news? Were you getting regular reports?
And about the Russians too. This is increasingly dramatic in the Russian news. But there was a set too on the front line which was somewhere towards Bologna. And then, of course, the Americans, they came down from the Apennines and entered Bologna first. And then the Germans virtually collapsed, withdrew to the Po. And they didn't defend the Po. And we had the DD tanks. We got over the Po very easily. And then the Adige the same. We thought that would be it. They thought they'd defend that, but they didn't.
Well, were you actually in action on day one, on the 10th of April? What were you doing
within a few days?
What were you doing then when during the course of this attack, going northwards into the Plain of Lombardy? What was your part in that?
It was interesting. I didn't get employed much. Squadron leader had me constantly in reserve, and I rather think, see, I got my gong in the Lehrer Valley, I rather think he wanted one of the others to have the opportunity to do the thing, and I wasn't used a lot. I did some when we first launched as a squadron, I did have had a piece of the front, and I remember making right in these fields trying to get through the ditches and through the thick hedges and that sort of thing, and I saw anybody.
Did you run?
And on another part of the divisional front, there was this great breakthrough in the Argenta Gap, and it was helter-skelter to the peril.
I mean, did you run into any opposition during this battle?
No.
What could you do about these ditches and so on? Was there anything you could?
No, we got out of them all right, as it happened. You had to be very careful and find a good place and see all your vehicles across. Three quarters of an hour could see them go, and then measure on another 400 yards and get another one. Mm-hmm. And that was the line of advance I was given there.
Any sign of the local population in that area?
I don't know. I think they were all for them. In their cellars.
So didn't get the same.
There's been a lot of them. I mean, it's a tremendous bombardment. Aerial and artillery bombardment. So they cut their heads down. Very much so. It wasn't like the part between the Lira Valley and the Boat to Bronze, the villages, the liberating villages, and anything like that. It was all. They just kept their heads down. I don't remember seeing much of them. And of course, I think they had a very rough time under the Germans. And then it was helter, when we got over the Adige, it was helter-skelter for the border.
Which border was that?
It was Austria. And then we got to Oudenaarde, and our orders were to go on into Yugoslavia by Caporetto. And we got to a place called Cividale, where we took over a hospital, a disused hospital.
Would this be in the peninsula around the Trieste area?
Not as far.
Not as far?
No. I don't know, about 20 miles beyond the Udine, I think. And, of course, on the night of the 7th of May, we heard that the war would end tomorrow, and then we were doing something to the tanks at the time. And well, everybody had the same idea, let's have a good party. Well, everything was, I didn't think they got any proper booze. And what they captured some stuff. Very doubtful origin, and I've never had anything like it. I mean, we had what they used to call a squadron smoker. Well, I went down, and the officers used to have to go, and I went down about half past seven, and it was awful. They were all knocked out by this drink. And John Tiop playing the piano and so on. You couldn't make sense of anybody. A few hours must have passed because I remember going outside and the house sergeants had been entertaining the Grenadier Guard sergeant. And they were in a bad state, they were being loaded up on little vehicles to send them back to their quarters. And then I think it was about after 11, I got to my where I was sleeping, and I had the candle, and I was going away at 11, out to this telephone call, out on the road at 3:30. And so we had a very early order group, and they went after the route that was given our route, which was towards Caporetto, not very much of waiting. Question was, who had enough sober drivers?
Did anybody have enough sober drivers?
There was a bit of lending from one group to another, I remember. And then we all got out, we got off to the approach night starting, and we got a few miles down the road, and we were told to halt and wait for fresh orders. And these eventually came through, and we had a turn about, go back to Udine, and then drive northwards into Austria. And we went past the harbour the night before, it was 8:30 in the morning, we could have had a few more hours in bed.
Did you know why? Why there was this change of direction?
I don't know. By then, what we found was in the last few days, the armistice was signed with the Allied armies in Italy on the 2nd of May.
Yes.
But then there was this problem with this German army group in the Balkans. That general didn't consider himself bound by that surrender. Because we thought, we've got to dislodge them from the Alps. It's going to take a long time. But of course then, so that's why, in this period, Tito sent all these bands as far as they could penetrate into Italy and Austria. And they took over these villages, the post office and police station. Heavily armed, well, with personal arms, a stick grenade, women too, in uniform, well, with a barrier and a red star. And I think his object was to lay claim to as much territory as possible, and then if he had to withdraw, then he'd still keep quite a lot. And I think Alexander had this problem that he didn't want to start fighting our wartime ally. And so there was a delay, and we thought, well, we'd better get Austria occupied. And so that's why, I think that's why we were directed out, sent in another direction. It was one of the most incredible days of my life, because we travelled along this road from across the frontier through these mountains, and all day long there were these people were coming towards us. In a terrible state, civilians, displaced persons who had got out of their camps and were making vow, all sorts of deprivation.
Do you know what sort of nationalities they were?
Oh, all was all Italian.
No heading back for Italy.
Forced labour. And half starved and sick. All day long, with the 20 yards of the man struggling along. Never seen anything like it before or since. And then when we went into Italy in March 44, people running naked were in a dreadful state. The news were far worse. Especially young men. And the Austrians, they were still working in the fields as if nothing had happened, making hay. And anyway, we got as far as Pilark, I think, at night. And then the generals had the problem. Well, I think we had a pitch on the birth side. But we were deployed to the south of the birth side, in this country that Tito was trying to occupy. And I was in support of the company of Welsh Guards, and remember passing this night in our tank in the delivery with these Tito guards outside. You see, we were, I couldn't think why we didn't bundle them all back to where they came from, but politics had taken over.
How much did you know about the political situation when you were being deployed in Austria?
Very little, yeah. Very little. We were under the impression that the Austrians were not Germans, and they were good people, they were being hijacked, you know. And anyway, one woman made it clear to one of our officers, it's not Ostreich, it's Ostmark, you know, and we're part of the Greater Reich and so on. But there weren't, otherwise, there wasn't much. We weren't allowed to fraternize. And of course, we had to commandeer houses and that sort of thing.
When you went to support the Welsh Guards, were they actually deployed in defensive positions?
No, they were just sort of occupying the area, really.
I mean, were you deployed as if you were expecting to be involved in action, or were you just...
Well, we had to be ready, yeah. We did. And we were under orders to treat our allies with respect.
Did you have any contact with them? Was such any direct contact?
No, I not really. I didn't. As I say, I had to put up with the indignity of having these people apparently on guard around my tank. Because we were under these orders, you know, we mustn't do anything to offend them. And we had similar jobs like that. All in, we were really amongst the slave leaders, who impressed me as a very docile people who were only concerned to work their life. And the defile firemen were going to the village church one Sunday. And I think that's been borne out by events that Slovenia has kept out of really serious trouble. relatively peaceful country. But there was in this part of Austria a large slave minority.